Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Hello and welcome to Working the Lectionary, a podcast in which the world of work is examined through readings from the weekly lectionary. My name is Brendan Byrne and I'm one of the co-hosts, and while we have been away for a little while for one reason and another, we're here now, and here also is my fellow host John Bottomley. John, hello and good to see you again.
Thanks, Brendan. Good to be back on the air.
Indeed it is. And in this episode we will be examining readings for the second and third Sundays in the season of Pentecost, both of which, it turns out, come to us from the Gospel according to Matthew. And the reading for Pentecost 2 is Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 to 13, then 18 to 26. A reading from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 9, verse 9 to 13, then 18 to 26. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And as he sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." While he was saying these things to them, suddenly a leader of the synagogue came in and knelt before him, saying, "My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live." And Jesus got up and followed him with his disciples. Then suddenly a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. For she said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be made well." Jesus turned and seeing her, he said, "Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well." And instantly the woman was made well. When Jesus came to the leader's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, "Go away, for the girl is not dead but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. And the report of this spread throughout the district.
Now, in this reading, we have several events brought together in a rather abbreviated form. First, there is the calling of Matthew, which was the subject of a famous painting by Caravaggio. Then there is the exchange between Jesus and the Pharisees on the subject of Jesus' association with those who are deemed to be sinners. And this is followed by the summons to heal the sick daughter of one of the religious leaders, which is interrupted by the woman who touches the hem of Jesus' cloak. There's a lot to unpack here, but it seems to me that a consistent theme that runs through this passage is the theme of healing, which, if we examine in light of Matthew's calling by Jesus, seems to suggest something about the vocation of the church in the world, to be and embody the healing presence of God's grace in a broken and wounded reality. But it also seems to suggest to me something about vocation itself, that the point of vocation is to be part of the healing grace of God in human life, calling us to a fullness of our humanity that is not reflected in modernity's construction of work and economy. If we think about that painting by the Italian master Caravaggio, he composes it in such a way that on the left side of the painting, we see Matthew sitting amidst the piles of tax money he has collected, surrounded by his cronies, Jesus is on the right side of the painting, one hand outstretched to Matthew in summons, and they are connected by a shaft of light that ostensibly comes through a window behind Jesus, but which illuminates both Jesus' outstretched arm and Matthew's rather surprised figure, connecting them both almost as though heaven and earth were connected. John, what do these two themes we see in today's reading about calling and healing illustrate the way in which modernity has perhaps gotten it wrong about occupation instead of vocation and wealth as distinct from relationship as the cure for our ills?
Thanks, Brendan. Before we get to that point, I think my sense is that the church has also got it wrong to the extent that it calling and healing are often separated.
Mm.
So it's like you're called to ministry and mission, and then the work that you do is healing and mission.
Yes.
And so calling and vocation, or calling and healing, are sort of bifurcated, separated, in a way that I've come to think is not healthy or indeed biblical.
Mm.
So the interesting thing about Matthew's calling, there are two things that stand out. The first is that the NRSV talks about after Jesus says, "Follow me," he got up. A stronger rendition of that word is he rose.
Mm.
Like he rose up.
Yes.
It's sort of a resurrection.
Yes. Word.
So he got up, just looks at the fact that he's moved from sitting to standing.
Mm.
But in fact, the movement is from an old identity to a new identity. Mm. It's a transformative shift. And the first thing that happens for Matthew, or it's implied, is that he sits then at dinner with Jesus.
Mm.
So the healing is part of the calling.
Mm.
He's actually embraced in the community of Jesus' followers.
Yes.
From that very moment.
Yes.
And one of the things that I experienced in my own experience of having my calling tested before being admitted to training was that the focus was on how had I experienced the calling.
Mm.
And it was only later in life that I realized that the church hadn't actually looked at what was God trying to heal through my call.
Mm.
So why was it important that I move from like failing in maths and sciences in my final year at high school to a vision of being called into ordained ministry in a different career without understanding the sense of shame and failure that I experienced failing maths and science. And so the calling became wrapped up in a sort of patriarchal understanding of career advancement, I was on this path to a new job, if you like. That was part of my understanding, and also from powerlessness to power. That was probably the more crippling one for me later in life. That the healing, the sense of powerlessness that I had in failing, hadn't been ever spoken about. And in fact, my family sort of rallied around me and helped me to get enough of the skills I needed to pass, so I could go on to this new path. But the reason why that I had actually experienced the need, or my openness to the call, I think, was never really focused on. And I saw that theme a number of times in the movement in my ministry, from one type of ministry to another. And then as a supervisor, I found that was the same thing was happening often with supervisees. Yes. So they would be talking about what were they called to, and I would then be sort of saying, but where's the wound? What's the pain? Where's the pain? What is it that God is rescuing you from? What is it that God is saving you from? And how is that going to be healed? It's not healed by leaving it, because you can't leave it.
Yes.
You take the wounds with you.
Yes.
So there's if you understand that the calling and the healing are sort of like two sides of the coin.
Yes.
And the healing is the product of the calling.
Yes.
And the calling is the precursor to the healing.
Yes.
Then you're going to be in a much healthier spot. And the way you frame the question then sort of comes alive, I think, because when I did some research in my Master of Ministry year, and I was interviewing Uniting Church members about their work and faith, and the question about calling was typically responded to as a professional person's identity.
Yes.
And it didn't register with people who thought their work was just a job.
Yes.
And so modernity has sort of captured the word of calling as a sort of a badge of honor for professional life. And people who have a calling of God or a calling of Christ to a particular occupation that's not a professional one, I missed out. And so when you look at the membership of the Uniting Church, which I did as part of that research in the late 90s, it's essentially probably three quarters of the membership of professional identities. You know, like the working class, that is the non-professional class, are very much underrepresented in the church's membership. Well, that's not a surprise when you look at the way we do business, the way we sort of speak to one another, the sorts of activities that we promote. There are not too many men's sheds even, you know, in the life of the church as a pastoral activity.
Yep. No. It's interesting that you touch on that issue of calling and healing, because it seems to me that the church too has very much stunted its understanding of vocation as being exclusively about religious vocation.
Oh, yes.
But also there are expressions of work and faith, particularly from the US evangelical churches, that twist vocation in another direction and make it about people using work as a forum to get recruits for the church, as it were. In that very narrow sense of mission. But what you're touching on seems to me to be reflected in something we often hear, where at some point in their quote unquote careers, you know, you hear stories about merchant bankers leaving to become teachers, and corporate lawyers leaving to become artists. And although they're earning significantly less amounts of money, there is a sense of fulfillment involved that makes the issue of money irrelevant. So there is a sense of a realization of a call to be and do something different that then brings a healing from all those needs and wants and anxieties that they thought they would get in these high-powered, well-paying jobs.
Yes. I think you're describing work as what I would call a living death. So people take on jobs that they think offer them the world, and they find that the way they're required to work robs them of their humanity, and so they exist in a form of living death. And I think that the two healing stories that follow the Matthew Call story are, if you like, metaphors for that. So the woman who essentially is bleeding to death, but her death is also a living death because she's isolated by the Puritan sort of structures of the religion, which is probably not a long way away from what you're talking about as well, that the sort of the morality, if you like, of the church favours certain types of work as being worthy, missing the point completely that the woman's healing here, as distinct from Mark's gospel, is not because she touches the hem, but because Jesus speaks to her the word of healing.
And
while she touches Jesus literally, he touches her spiritually or in a healing touch that transforms her status, and she's immediately embraced in the community again. And the powerful thing about Jesus' touch is that her impurity doesn't transfer to him, which is what the whole religious structure said it would.
Yes.
But in fact, what's transferred to her is a divine blessing, if you like it. And it's in that sense that when people move from these sort of high status jobs to something that's giving them more relational value and a better connection, if you like, with the community, that transformation has about it that sort of echo of transcendence, if you like, of divine sort of blessing.
And I think that there's a link there to that episode in that this reading where the religious authorities say to Jesus, look, you know, why are you breaking bread with these sinners? And we have that in modernity's construction of work in as much as the unemployed or the underemployed or those who prioritize forms of work that aren't waged labor are routinely dismissed as parasites or, in the words of one politician, you know, leaners, not lifters, you know. So in both that religious construction in Jesus' day and in the economic construction of today, there are those who are deemed to be righteous.
Yes.
And those who are deemed to be unclean and unrighteous and unworthy of belonging to the community of the righteous. And yet Jesus associates with them and doesn't just associates with them, but rebukes the religious leaders.
Yes, indeed.
So how does that rebuke speak into the moral values that are assigned to work, to the ideology of work, and to how adverse moral qualities are assigned to the unemployed, for example?
Well, I think the moral value, like, if you like, from an sort of an Ignatian sort of phrase, is God is found in all life, whereas modernity sets up dualisms of hierarchical value and hierarchical negative value, lack of value. So I think you're describing people like as unemployed as having low value, essentially because they're unproductive in the value system of a market economy. But in the divine economy, Jesus actually goes in the second story to a child, low productivity, dead. That's pretty low, you know, got no productivity here. And in fact, the funeral's already started.
Yes.
That's how dead she is. Yes. You know, like, it's not just a mistaken, you know, diagnosis. And what Jesus does is in the same, with a similar outcome, he touches he takes the child's hand, completely against the Puritan code. So he's risking, according to the medical understanding of the day, he's risking disease.
Yes.
He's risking death.
Yes.
By touching death.
Yes.
And that's how the modern world deals with people who it castigates as valueless. Doesn't touch them. Doesn't touch them. And the last probably 15 years have just shown how brutal that is.
Yes.
In the attitude of governments up to today towards people on unemployment benefits.
Yes.
Don't touch them.
Yes.
Just left them to hang out to dry.
Yes.
So the morality is pretty stark, I think.
Yes.
You know, as a citizen, I find that shameful, let alone as a as a Christian. It's Albanese's talking about being on the right side of history in terms of voting for the referendum, but the scripture's actually talking about being on the right side of God. And if you're not in relationship with God, then that is what sin is. These moral code definitions of sinners are a product of the religious Puritan movement trying to sort of, trying to protect the people, trying to sort of maintain a certain health and safety, but they're missing the point because the deeper issue is life and death.
Yes.
And to consign people to a living death in the case of the woman with the hemorrhage, or to actually, you know, leave the man who comes to Jesus with a bereavement, go against Jesus' understanding of what God requires of us. And so he touches the dead. He touches the person who's impure and unclean.
Mm.
And we've got a long way to go as a church before people say that about the Uniting Church. Mm. We talk a lot about justice, but not a lot about getting our hands dirty.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that because the Australian academic Peter Fleming, who used to be University of London, I think, and who is now at UTS in New South Wales.
Oh, okay. Mm.
He talks about work as a living death, as a parasitic system that feeds off the bios, the very bios of human life, because it co-opts all of our social skills and our capacity for flexibility and ingenuity to dissolve the differences between work and non-work so that it takes over the whole of our lives.
Yeah.
And he describes how large corporations in particular import all the outward signs of community, so cafes and gyms and on-site childcare and on-site welfare programs and all of this sort of thing to replicate all the things that happen in our external wider lives beyond the control of work and bring them into work so that we think that actually life is what is happening in the workplace. And so we become in the terms of one of his books, Dead Men Working.
Oh yes.
You know. And so it's a real death in life. And yet the church's absence from the world of work seems to indicate its own fear of touching that death. Yes. Possibly because of its own replication of that death in its own structures.
I think you're onto something there. I think you could also say that the church is really almost at a rapid pace being removed from the world of death.
Mm.
So death is becoming sanitized, and the church is no longer regarded as even the first or second choice. We're down probably third or fourth, you know, of what a bereaved family might look for.
Yes, yes.
In response to death. So the fact that we are being marginalized in the death industry is congruent with our fear of the dying of the church and that wider fear about the death-dealing nature of capitalist work practices.
Mm.
That's strike three.
Mm. So approaching this text with all its different aspects and all its different themes, what are the key things that someone wanting to preach on this text and relate it to the world of work, what do you think they need to be focusing on?
I think it's pretty straightforward in a sense. I think a preacher needs to be encouraging members to be aware of God's calling on their life.
Mm.
It doesn't need to be in relation to paid employment, that God calls us to all manner of things. It's an ancient, an old Lutheran understanding, which I find resonant. And I think liturgically we are shortchanging our congregations with the lack of healing prayer. So how would we think about inviting people to not only be attentive to the calling, but how is God calling them out of an unhealthy or unsafe or painful past? And how would we put that at the altar? How would we bring that before God in prayer? And I think the sort of prayer for healing in the Uniting in Worship is actually a good framework for attending to that. And so I think that the connecting the preaching to the prayer of the church is actually called for here, because I think we need to get a better sense of the healing ministry, if you like, and how it is sort of hand in glove with calling. And that then speaks into the sort of, you know, 30 years I was occupied in dealing with work-related death and the failure of state instrumentalities like the Work Cover Authority to care for those who are bereaved. And if you don't care for those who are bereaved, you're never going to fully understand why these tragic incidents happen. So for the church is in the same space. It's no point learning about industrial deaths from the newspaper. It's about pastorally engaging with people who have experienced the pain of some work-related death and embracing that in the liturgy, in preaching, and in prayer.
Well, then, I think on that note, it is time we now moved on to our reading for Pentecost 3, which comes to us from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 9, verse 35, through to chapter 10, verse 8.
A reading from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 9, verse 35, to chapter 10, verse 8. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and curing every disease and every sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits, to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles: first, Simon, also known as Peter, and his brother Andrew; James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John; Philip and Bartholomew; Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector; James, son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus; Simon the Cananean; and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: "Go nowhere among the Gentiles, and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You received without payment, give without payment."
And again in this reading we have a series of small episodes: Jesus journeying through the countryside, teaching and healing, the summoning of the 12 apostles, and the commissioning of the 12 to go about their mission of proclaiming the gospel. And again, it appears to me that we have a common theme running through these vignettes, which is the work of the church, the community of faith itself. And in that context, I'm struck by Jesus' response to the need of the people, which is filled with compassion because, as the text says, they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. That, to me, is a deeply striking image of human despair and suffering. And I'm wondering if Jesus were to come among us today, whether he would not have a similar reaction, both in terms of the church's failure to live out its mission, as evidenced, for example, by its almost total absence from the world of work, but also from the sense of emptiness and despair that arises from the false and broken promises of consumerist capitalism. I'm also struck by that passage at the very end of the reading where Jesus says, "You received without payment, give without payment." And I'm wondering how perhaps this passage has become problematic insofar as the work of the church is perceived, especially with respect to those who undertake that work from a calling into religious vocation.
I thought you were going to insert an advertisement for the Faith Workers Alliance, Brendan.
Would I do that? Never, never.
That's a tricky issue.
Mm.
I think maybe we come back to it. The underlying theme is about ministry as a gift of grace. Mm. So as apostles, or the apostles are sent because they've already experienced something of Jesus' call and healing and understood that as a gift.
Mm.
So that sort of sets the whole all in motion. Then the response to that is, and I think this is where the church has sort of lost the plot more than it, like as a payment issue. The church in Australia really has benefited materially from its so-called mission.
Mm.
Church schools, the funding by governments of church agencies, the theft of land from Indigenous people for church parishes. I remember when I researched the history of St. George's East St. Kilda on Chapel Street. I'm not sure whether the name came from the fact that next door to the, what was at that point a Presbyterian church was a Church of England. There was a militia unit next door from the 19th century, and then the next two properties were Free Presbyterian and some other denomination. So the colonial government had allocated four blocks of land to different denominations in that part of Chapel Street, all stolen land, you know, like acquired by the Crown, by the authority of the Crown. So when St. George's was recently sold to a local school, it was reportedly $4 million. So that doesn't square off too well with you receive without payment, you know, give without payment. So the church has been living off its stolen property and its acquired property that's been, and to my mind, that's all just such a corrupting of our belief. To then talk about what that means for the payment of people, I think, whether it's ordained ministers or staff, I think that's a complicated issue. Like, I think it needs, all these things need to be set in a historical context and within a, you know, the current culture. So I don't really have a problem with people being, because I think people being paid as according to their due. I think that the scripture sort of says something of that too.
The labour being worthy of the hire.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense that sets up a negotiation or a discussion. I think that the biblical imperative in that context is to be aware of the fact that you start out on the journey with no money. you know, you leave your gold at home, don't bring extra clothes, all that sort of thing. So I think if the church was serious about this, there'd be a conversation about it that's more than about industrial relations. And how does, if the church wants its paid staff to be in some sense a model, then it's incumbent on the whole community, because the image here really is not transactional, it's relational.
Yes.
So if there's going to be a discussion about our worth, what's our worth, and we accept that the people that we're ministering to have a part in that conversation, then how does the church do that? Now, in my sort of almost 50 years of ordained ministry, the decisions about stipend are dealt with by a select committee of the synod, or previously the Methodist Conference. And they go away and they look at all manner of statistics and come back with a figure. And all of that was done in a sense like an industrial court. Not like a congregation of the, you know, like trying to sort of wrestle with what does this mean. So in a sense, I think the gap between what the intent of the scripture might be and where we're at is so great now that it's hard to sort of see how to embrace that without some sort of confession that 200 or 300 years ago we moved, the church moved away from being part of the working world, and as the church moved into a sort of what I call a suburban ministry sort of space of home and hearth, our capacity to engage with any of the issues around work dissipated. And today we're in this terrible position. You read these texts and you think, oh my God.
Yes. So have through, for example, its acquisitions in colonialism, has the church gone from that position of leaving with nothing to being totally encumbered?
Very much encumbered. Which is not the rhetoric. I think that, you know, if we're going to keep prattling on about being the biggest community services provider in Australia, there ought to be at least a sort of a sense of embarrassment about how much property we've acquired out of that. And the poor are still with us type of thing.
Well, that in itself in relation to work is an interesting issue, because all the mainstream churches are heavily vested through their agencies and allied institutions in aged care.
Oh, yes.
And because of that, they receive substantial government and state funding. And yet, as a sector, as an industry sector, it is notorious for its exploitation of industrially weak workers and economically marginalized workers. And so on the one hand, while the church makes a great play of being involved in aged care and looking after a vulnerable population, it is involved in the economic structures of exploiting another group of people as well as taking coin from the state.
Yes, yes. And that's pretty much an ecumenical sin. It's not the sort of pandemic really showed up how much the church in its ecumenical sort of frame was invested in using or taking money in the name of care to build substantial empires. Shameful.
So I want to go back to that earlier point about Jesus' compassionate response to the people as he's traveling amongst them. And really, for me, that quite striking description, they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. I mean, reading that, I was actually caught by the emotional depths of that description because it is, you know, quite a rending depiction of people in a state of complete despair.
Yes.
And it caused me to think about my own experience of work and the workplace. And I would have to say that in every workplace in which I have worked, I've had a sense of the people around me being harassed and helpless through their own powerlessness in the structures of power in the workplace, through their need to indulge in workplace gossip as a compensation for that, for their complete inability to have any kind of agency. And the illusion that if they get higher up the ladder, that will somehow change. And yet engaging and encountering managers and line managers and so forth who were in just as harassed and helpless a position.
Yes.
How can the church reach out to this world? How can the church engage the harassed and helpless humanity of modernity in the workplace? Because far from traveling through this landscape of despair, it seems to me that the church is doing the opposite, that it is in fact withdrawing into itself and into its own internal concerns.
The crux of the matter is that there is within the Uniting Church a level of harassment, helplessness, and living like sheep without a shepherd. So you know, there's sort of talk about another strategic plan at the synod level. Well, what happened to the last one? So, and the one before that, you know, like I can think probably of three or four strategic plans now in the last dozen years.
And the irony for me is that replicates exactly what I went through, particularly when I was working in the finance industry, of right-sized and process re-engineered and downsized and reviewed and all the rest of it.
So I think it's the mistake. Perhaps, not the mistake, but the difficulty with your question, Brendan, is that it assumes that the church has actually got anything to offer to the world in its state of harassment and despair, unless we were able to bring that harassment before God. So the critical thing, it seems to me, is that we don't pray, in a way. I mean, I don't mean to be facetious about that, but we're so sort of self-important and self-actualizing that whenever we run up against a problem, we think we have to solve it. And as I want to say to myself, sit down with the problem, bring it to a contemplative space, and pay attention to how God is looking at me in my harassment or in my despair, and understand that the only salvation that really I have to discover is what God has to say to me about that, and to recover then a sense of my humanity, so that the helplessness and the despair is the state of being that triggers Jesus' compassion. So the connection between trusting that God is a compassionate God, not a judgmental God. God judges, that's clear, but not harshly. It comes back to that statement, I think, in the previous reading, that God looks at the world with mercy. Mercy's the, not sacrifice. So mercy's the starting point here. So we have a lot. We have a lot to be confident about in opening our hearts to God. Yeah, and the church could be focusing, like in its leadership, on being vulnerable and being open with people about how they deal with the sense of despair, you know, in the church in its state of decline and its aging and all the rest of it. I mean, these are just real phases of life.
Yes.
You know, I'm 75.
Yes.
You know, I'm long past pretending that I'm not getting older and that my energy is limited and there are things that I can't do that I used to do. But is that a cause for despair? Not really. And yet, you talk to people who are getting age older and they can only see it as a reason for despairing. I don't despair that I'm not 60. I think about the madness of when I was, I don't want to go back to running around like that.
Yes.
But that's not really the point. But that's not the main point. The key point is, I think, the good news about sin is that it's forgiven. So I think that.
But is that part of the problem then, that that we don't actually really trust that?
No, we don't. No. We'd rather talk about being on the right side of history and sounding very sort of plausible and sensible rather than saying we've got to be on the right side of God. And God's actually on the right side waiting for us. It's about restoring the relationship.
And is that likewise then linked with something that I encounter all the time, and that is that people don't actually really believe in the resurrection. And so they continue to try and develop strategies to save themselves.
That's exactly the problem. From a Christian point of view, that's just folly. And in fact, it's probably sin itself. To think that I can be God in my own life and save myself is fundamentally a sin against God. I don't need you, God. I can look after this. Give us a break.
And is that embedded in the narrative of modernity, which tells us that authentic humanity, human flourishing, is vested in our self-realizing capacity? And yet as soon as we go into a workplace and encounter structures of power that render us helplessness, or render us helpless, rather, then the product is despair.
Yes, yes. I mean, one of the insights from my sort of 15 years of going to a men's group every fortnight, you know, when I had energy for that, was discovering that powerlessness is part of the human condition, and that men and women feel powerless often, and there are many situations where your power is taken from you, but you're never powerless to the powerlessness of itself. Is not a denigrating thing. It's simply an experience of life, and it might be caused by injustice. So God hates injustice. And so focus on the injustice and what's God doing about that. And the focus is not on my despair about the powerless, being powerless. God's sort of really saying, well, I'm looking at you and you're okay. You know, you're one of my children, so get on board. And once we start that conversation, it happens quite often in our congregation that I'm part of, that we set up a conversation where people share as sort of as an experience about something in their working life or their family life. And rather than then turning that into a problem that everyone tries to solve, we say, what has that resonated with you? And everybody then talks about how they're hearing that story and how it touches them. Because the key thing in particularly the earlier stories about touch, or even about the ministry of the 12, is that our touch is only as effective as God's touching us. So there's a power in being touched by other people's story that in traditional trade union terms is solidarity.
Yes. Yes.
And for me, I prefer to talk about the solidarity of sin. Because it is that moment of disclosure that is a graced moment. You don't really know what the sin is and how it's wearing you down until you've got the grace, the gift of grace that allows you to speak it. And in that sort of speaking it, there's a mystery of presence which creates a bond between people, and that's energizing and spirit-giving. Creates energy for acting justly. I think that's the background to this whole little thing at the end about money, but how you go about the ministry amongst the Gentiles.
So in this reading, and in the reading for Pentecost too, in these acts of calling and healing and ministry, is it actually about Jesus' solidarity with us and our suffering humanity?
I think so.
And does that then in turn place a call upon the church, particularly in relation to what you experienced through your ministry with those bereaved by work-related death?
Yeah, I think so. And the reality, I think, of a healed call is what is called a wounded healer. You know, that people would come into that program for healing, and you knew when the healing was taking place because they would then want to share their story with other people. And that built up a sort of a cascading or a rippling effect. And you can get a bit of a picture. One of the commentaries on this ministry of the 12 says, in RSV translations, Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles. And one commentary says it's actually, don't go on Gentile roads.
Okay. Okay.
And that reading is a thoughtful way of sailing. Just be aware that you can move around because the Romans built these roads and we know what the Romans are up to.
Yeah.
So it's not about going, it's not a prohibition about ministry with the Gentiles. It's a warning. You know,
don't walk on the same road as the Romans.
And it then sets up the background as to why you travel light. So don't get caught up in the Roman economy. Don't get caught up in the Roman way of life. Don't get sort of submerged in capitalist sort of glitterati. Because when the crunch comes, you want to know that you can survive trusting in God's providence.
That's really interesting. I actually quite like that. It reminds me of that famous passage from Job: I know that my Redeemer lives, which has become the basis of any number of prayers and hymns.
Yes.
But there are scholars who argue that it's actually Job's cry of despair, saying, I would rather be redeemed while I live.
Yes.
Which then flips it. If you want to make that a prayer and a hymn, that really flips the emphasis and direction of it. You know, it's coming out of a place of despair.
Yes, that's right.
And a desire for solidarity. I think there's an echo in that different reading of that passage.
Very much so. Yeah.
So concluding thoughts on this passage, preaching on this passage about work and faith.
Perhaps I think that I could imagine sort of people listening to us from time to time would feel like everything that we've got to say about work or capitalism is sort of this negative, you know, sort of heavy burden.
Yeah.
But at the heart of it, you really are called to listen to the compassionate Christ. You know, Jesus is saying, look, I understand about the harassment. I understand about the despair. And it moves me, you know, like, and so Jesus is out in all the cities and the villages, you know. He's going as far as he can, you know, to bring that sort of compassionate touch to those who need it. And I think that the people who have written scripture and put the heading like the mission of the 12 do us a disservice because they make it look like this is a project.
Yes.
But I think it's a an educational tool.
Yes.
So it's more of an action research or an action reflection thing. I've shown you how to do this for 10 chapters or 9 chapters. I'm going to let you go have a crack at it now. You can see what we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
Go out and have a go at it. And just be aware that, you know, there are forces at work all the time that are trying to stop what I've been doing, you know, in God's name. And then we'll have a get together and have a talk about it. And see what we've learned and actually get a deeper understanding of the corporate capitalism, if you like, or a deeper understanding of patriarchy. But we want to build our understanding of what we're dealing with here before we have to deal with, you know, the more demonic sort of powers of death that are just there all the time. But we keep pushing up against them. Learn about them and strengthen ourselves.
Almost like the disciples being apprenticed into their ministry.
Apprenticeships. I think if we understood discipleship as apprenticeship, I think it would be a lot healthier.
Yes.
And some of the sort of holier-than-thou sort of stuff that goes on when we talk about discipleship, I find it distasteful.
Well, that's a nice metaphor, I think, of discipleship as apprenticeship, as a process of learning. Yeah, definitely.
The other thing that does is that it actually opens up a conversation about who holds the wisdom to be an apprentice master. I mean, clearly that's how Jesus, we're presenting Jesus to our listeners in this. But at the human level, who do we look to? And it's really interesting at the moment in this debate about the referendum and the voice and so on, that the Indigenous community has such a clear respect for the wisdom of the elders compared with the sort of marginalising of aged people. And you know, Uniting Church, people sort of look at, I don't want to have a ministry with old people. because we just don't. We don't understand where wisdom might live. And I'm not saying that old people have an innate wisdom because our culture actually drips it away. But so there's some huge questions, I think, being asked in our society at the moment about what would be an authentic apprenticeship model for a healthy society and whether the church could be modelling something. That would be quite exciting.
Absolutely. Well, I think on that point, we can draw our discussion for today to a close. In our next episode, we'll look at readings for the 4th and 5th Sundays of the Pentecost season. But for now, John, thank you as always for your company today.
Thanks again, Brendan. Good to be back on the air.
It is indeed. And if any of our listeners would like to leave comments, suggestions or feedback, please go to the podcast website at www.workingthelectionary.podbean.com. Working the Lectionary is available on Podbean, the hosting service for this podcast, but it is now also available through Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, TuneIn and iHeartRadio. In the meantime, John and I look forward to your company for the next episode. Goodbye for now.
This has been Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary.